Blog Talk Radio.
This is Sana Cody. Just listened to an elder from Guwao. And welcome once again to Indigenous Caribbean Taino Study Hour. And we have with us once again her name from the mountains of Philly. That's her name is Natalie Huber Rodriguez, anthropologist in the house. How are you?
What's up, man? I heard you. You got my name right this time. I was really excited for that.
Yo, I've been practicing hard, man.
Yeah, I heard you. I could like hear you thinking about it as right before you said my last name. I was like, oh, he's gonna do it this time. I can feel it.
I took a deep breath, and I said, I gotta get it right because yeah. From the mountains of Philly. That's right, man. We got this. We got this.
There we go.
Man, that just gets me, you know?
Yeah. I get excited every time I hear that.
Well, you were there last month, right? You were at the statue last month, man. It's
Oh, yeah, exactly. Yeah, I'm there pretty much every week these days. It's a train ride away.
Oh, man, that is so cool. You got to take me out there one day. Well, I'll meet you over there.
Absolutely.
I love Rocky Balboa. Yeah, man.
Absolutely. Italian stallion.
Oh, man. Well, you know, speaking of fighters, you know, talking about Cubao, right?
Yeah.
I'm thinking of, you know, not too long ago, I was showing this video. It's called Proyecto Cuba Indígena, about
right.
You know, Cacique Panchito in his community in Cuba, Cubao. And that first song was sung by one of the elders, you know.
Yes, that is Reina Rojas Ramirez. I know, yes, I believe that's her name, Reina. She is one of the elders. That song is just, it's haunting, you know, when you hear it and you hear her sing it. It's beautiful and you really, it takes you back, you know.
Oh, man. You know, I remember back in the 90s when Taino Nation went to Cuba, I wasn't able to go. But some of the, you know, they sent a contingency. They came back with that song. People started singing that song. And but I don't remember the whole song. This is the first time when I heard this video, the actual, you know, like the beginning. And because in all my ceremonies, I sing this song, but only the last part that I remember, you know.
Right, right.
You know, and I'm telling you, man, when I heard this couple of, it was last week, actually, I came across this video. It just brings you there, right, to that mountain, man. And it's like, wow, man.
Yeah, absolutely. Her voice is so, it's so pure and it's so haunting. And it's, yeah, that's what I was saying. It takes you back. You can picture yourself there. She's singing about the mountains in Juanma. And yeah, for me at least, every time I hear that song, it like sends a chill down my spine, you know, especially when I hear it. I've heard her sing it before too, and
wow.
I've heard other people sing it, but you're right, she was the first one I heard sing it too, and she's got a beautiful voice, and you can tell she's just putting so much of her own feeling into it, and it's really amazing.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I don't know how many times she sang this song. I know since the 90s.
Right.
I sang the last part, at least, that I can remember hundreds of times. And I saw her crying at the end, and that's it. She got touched by an ancestor.
Yeah.
And
absolutely.
It never ends being touched. And I was like, wow, man, that's deep, man. And I saw Panchito. He's I guess he's up there in age, right? Because he was,
he's got to be, I want to say he's at least, if not at least in his 90s, I want to say he's in his late 80s. But he's so vibrant still, because I told you I'm in contact with his nephew on a kind of regular basis, and he sends me, you know, videos and photos all the time. And you see Panchito in those old videos, and you just see how you know, vibrant and passionate he is when he talks about this kind of stuff. He's very lively, right? And from the videos I've seen, he's still like that. He's just as vibrant. He's just as passionate, especially when he talks about his ancestors and his upbringing and his history and his culture. You wouldn't know he's as old as he is, but I want to say, I'm not positive, but I want to say he's at least 90.
No, wow, that's amazing. They're still going strong. You know, he has a mission, you know. That's, and,
absolutely.
I mean, he's very spiritual. You know, he's rooted. I remember it was a magazine that I had from the Smithsonian when I first started the Mobile Indigenous Library. And right now it was stolen from my table. I couldn't believe it, but it was Panchito.
Oh, no.
Yeah, it was the article that he received the bones, ancestral bones, Cuban indigenous bones, and it was the reburial ceremony, and Cacique Jorge had donated that magazine to the Mobile Library, and I couldn't believe, I don't know how many people read through that article who was like, oh, Taínos don't exist, like, what are you talking about?
Right.
I'm like, all right, I'm going to show you an article, and they're like speechless, like, what? And that was my best article I used to give people who fought the extinction, you know, who supported the extinction myth, and it's lost forever, man. I couldn't believe someone, I don't know, it's like, wow. I mean, I've lost a lot of books throughout I've lost a lot of books throughout the years, but never such a priceless magazine, you know, like.
Right, yeah, that's a shame. Well, maybe it found its way into someone's good hands, hopefully.
That's a good way of looking at it.
I'm trying to look on the bright side here. Maybe it helps somebody debunk the extinction myth further, if you want to put a positive spin on it. But yeah, that community in general, and it's funny because something just came up the other day, and it's weird how things work out like that. Like somebody posted on one of the Taino groups I think it was Saino Beauties, because obviously I'm a part of that group, you know.
Oh, right, right. Of course.
I had it, somebody roped me and somebody invited me to join that group. Well, you know, obviously, but but somebody goes like, yeah, somebody posts a question. She said something like, and you know, she meant no harm. She was just genuinely curious. She goes, why do Cubans seem to have so much less Taino blood and Puerto Ricans seem to have a lot? My father told stories of the Taino killing themselves rather than being taken as slaves in Cubao, but I don't know how true that is. And it's funny that that kind of has perpetuated as yet another myth that is untrue, that Cubanos somehow are less Taino than Boricans or Dominicans or anything. But it's really not the case. And what I explained, I did respond to that, as did Dr. Barreiro, because he, of course, is a fellow Taino from Cubao, and he's the one who really went and formed relationships though in that whole community.
Right.
But we were all equally populated by Taino people before Columbus, and on average, really, DNA tests and all sorts of ethnic studies have shown that we don't really have any less heritage than any of the other islands. That whole idea that, oh, there's no evidence left of Taino genetics in Cuba is really not true. And that's especially true in the eastern provinces. That's where, of course, Cacique Panchito's community is, and that's where the Caridad de los Indios is, in those eastern provinces especially, because it's very rugged out there, a lot of mountains, a lot of difficult terrain. So that's where a lot of the Tainos fled when they were trying to escape Spanish persecution. It was a good place to hide. And the difference why, I guess, Cubanos don't, it's not as prominent, I guess, the whole idea of modern-day Taino heritage and Taino culture is not as prominent in Cuba as it is in, say, Puerto Rico or other islands. And it really, in my opinion, it kind of is rooted in the revolution, because the communist revolution really oppressed the idea of separate racial identities, you know, black, white, indigenous, whatever, and instead wanted everybody to focus on being one united and nationalistic Cuban identity, cubanismo, as they call it, basically saying, you know, your race doesn't matter. What matters is that you're Cuban, and that's what we really want to promote. So regardless of what your racial makeup was, it was all about, you know, being Cuban. Everybody's Cuban. We are all loyal to the state, and that's how it is. And so because of that, the idea of separate racial and ethnic makeups, and including indigenous people, was kind of oppressed a lot. They didn't like people talking about their individual heritages, their individual cultures or ethnic makeup. What a lot of people say, too, is, I see a lot of Cuban Americans and they look more European or white, I guess people say, which, you know, that phenotype only goes so far. That could be true. But as we know, indigenous people can look whatever, you know, just because somebody is lighter skinned or lighter hair or eye doesn't make them less indigenous. It's genes are a funny thing, and people can come out looking whatever way. But it is true that a lot of the Cuban Americans that people see are those who immigrated post-revolution. So they tend to be more of European Spanish descent, because they were the wealthier citizens who were ousted by the regime. So they were the ones who lost everything when the regime came around. And yes, on average, they tended to be more of Spanish European descent, because, you know, that's usually how it is. The wealthier higher ups were the whiter people, right? You're not going to see as many Afro-Cubans or indigenous Cubans in that demographic. A lot of the Cuban Americans you'll see in the Miami area, especially the ones who came post-revolution, are going to be more of Spanish descent. But again, it could be that they do have Taino in them as well, and they just don't know it, or they don't talk about it, because again, the idea of Cubanismo is not to really talk about those separate racial identities. But if you look at the general population of Cuba, it's very admixed, and most people you see, if you go to Cuba itself, which last time I was there was a few years ago, but most people are of mulatto or mestizo or both background, and you can see it in them, you know. And I personally have always known I was mestizo, you know, Spanish and indigenous mix. But because of the revolution and the regime that is still in place, there really hasn't been a huge Taino restoration movement in Cuba like there has been in Puerto Rico. But in spite of this, in recent years, especially, like we're talking about, you know, Cacique Panchito and Jose Barrero and everything and all the work they've been doing, there have been a lot of academic studies, because one thing Cubans love is learning. We're very studious and very academic people. So a lot of people kind of jumped on board on that when this project came around of looking into indigenous heritage and indigenous culture. So there's a lot of studies out there, including the one we were just talking about from that video that show, as well as cultural studies too, that show that Taino genetic and cultural heritage are alive and well in Cuba. It just hasn't been as broadcasted, I would say,
exactly,
over the past few years.
Exactly, exactly. I think that's so important to stress, you know, Cuba being, you know, with the blockade and the embargo and all that stuff. It's just, you know, it's definitely the monumental work of Jose Barrero and yourself as well. You know, that's just, it's more and more we're learning more about Cuba, and I wish we put all the politics to the side, all our politics, and really get into it. But it's so hard, man.
Tell me
so
about
difficult.
It. Right? It is. And it's so, especially as someone like myself who is, you know, Cuban American, just making it so difficult to see family, to send send things to people, like even to, like obviously with COVID and everything, Cuba has been suffering a lot. Like, you know, many nations have, but Cuba is an island, and because of the embargo and everything, they're so cut off from getting a lot of supplies they really need. And I mean, that was true before COVID, but then after COVID, I mean, things have just really gone downhill. You know, we talk to our family over there all the time, and it's impossible to get anything nowadays, especially medicines. I mean, they're nowhere near getting the vaccine as widespread like we have.
I can imagine.
But just basic supplies, you know, soap and laundry detergent, what have you. A lot of people, they said, have resorted to trading, like old-fashioned just trading with each other to try to get the stuff they need. And of course, over here, we always think like, you know, we have so, my mom and I are like, we have so much, and we try to help out, you know, we try to send them what we can, but it's hard because we can't do it, you know, we can't do it by the books. It's because it's not legal. So I like to call it, we have like this sort of almost like underground railroad-esque kind of thing where we pass it from friend to friend to friend, and somehow it gets over there, you know, and when you don't ask questions, you just kind of, you find people who know people, and they do what they have to do, and they get it there.
Exactly. Wow. It's survival mode, right? Trying to survive.
Right.
Well, have you heard of any issues with the COVID-19 in Panchito's community or anything? Has it hit hard there? Or?
Well, when I was talking to his nephew most recently, he said their community, thankfully, it really hasn't, because I think because they are so remote and they're more isolated. In the country itself, yes, there have been a lot of cases. Thankfully, from what I can hear from him, that they really haven't been affected, and you know, God willing, it stays that way. But what that also means, probably last on the list, if even they're on the list now, for any vaccine that could be coming. I mean, and as I said, the current situation in Cuba, I don't even know if and when any vaccination process is going to start, because they don't even have basic antibiotics or anything at the moment, because he was telling me he had some skin issues, some skin infection or something, and he couldn't even get like a topical cream or something to put on that, you know, like stuff we can grab in the pharmacy. He couldn't even get that, so he was using indigenous medicine, actually using plants and everything, because that's all he could do. And thankfully, he does have that knowledge to do so. But I can't imagine they'll be getting any vaccinations or anything anytime soon, unfortunately.
Wow, that's difficult. That's a difficult scene. You know, I was reading an article too about these third world countries that they don't really, you know, they're having a hard time with the COVID because of the vaccines. They don't have access to them. Well, the government doesn't have enough resources, right? So, but it seems like, you know, being in nature, the mountains, you know, living, you know, eating well, that's a great deterrent. Hopefully that will continue for Panchito's community.
Yeah, it's funny. He was saying to me, like, a lot of them are their elders. Like I said, you know, we were talking about Panchito earlier, who's like at least 90. He was saying like, oh yeah, we tend to, our whole family in our community, we tend to live pretty long, like 80s, 90s. He was saying his one aunt lived till she was like 100 or something. So I would say that speaks to that as well, because, you know, for all the problems Cuba has, is struggling as a nation, at least in that community, they seem to be doing, they take care of their elders. That's the one thing, of course, you know, whereas sometimes in Western culture, we have this unfortunate idea of kind of throwing our elders away or really not wanting to bother or invest with them anymore. We, you know, we put them in homes or whatever we do. We don't really value them as much. So I think that is part of it. When you're committed to caring for your elders and you see the value in them and you're invested in caring for them. But also, yeah, I think their environment and their community definitely contributes to it as well, because he sends me pictures all the time. Like, they harvest a lot of their own food, fruits and vegetables.
Yeah.
They cook a lot of it outside themselves in traditional barbacoa style. They make regular journeys up into the mountains to harvest other stuff at different times of the year. So, yeah, I would say that's definite evidence of that. And I would say for Cuba in general, that is one thing I have noticed. And I, you know, I'm not saying it's all related to the political situation in the government, but Cuba does have universal health care as a result of the current regime. So that is helpful to people, and especially to elders. I was reading something the other day that of all the Latin American countries, Cuba has the, you know, the highest, or what's the word? They live the longest. Like, statistics show that the people who live the longest of all the Latin American countries, or have the highest ages when they do die, are the people of Cuba. And they say it could be related to the fact that there is universal health care. Granted, it has tons of drawbacks, of course, as we were just discussing. But at least, unlike obviously here or anything, anybody can get the care that they need without having to pay for insurance or anything like that. They are a very intimate culture. You know, they're still doctors who make house calls and everything and care for elderly people. I mean, my cousin's mother just died at 95 or something, and he was taking care of her with the help of doctors, of course. But so, you know, that's one good thing at least.
Yeah, that's great. No, you know, I remember when I was younger going to a funeral of one of my great uncles. And I remember one of his daughters was lamenting, and she was saying, wow, his grandparents lived very, very old. The children came to New York to die young, you know, to die younger. So it was like, wow, because of the, you know, the diseases and like, again, like cares, like, oh man, you know, long work hours takes a toll.
Yeah,
so it was like, leaving that mountain, right? There's some risk to it. You know, on those...
Exactly, yeah. Well, if you go from like a pristine wilderness to a city, yeah, especially. I mean,
yeah.
and if you're not used to that even, but I mean, I posted a picture the other day of my abuela, my grandmother, who's going to be 90 in September, so.
Wow.
She's doing all right. And her mother, my bisabuela lived until she was like 98 or something. So, I think we as in general Latino culture even too as well. I think we do take care of our elders as well. I mean, at least in my family, we never put anyone in a home, and we never will.
Mm-hmm. You know what's funny? When I was in Puerto Rico in Corozal, I was in the middle of an argument between two men that were older, and one was saying, you know, I remember my grandmother telling me it was horrible, we were barefooted and this and that, disease, blah, 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 and I remember being poor, and then the other man was like, what do you mean poor? You know, I was raised in a mountain, I had no shoes, but guess what, I was in the river, I took fruits from the tree, I didn't have to spend a dime, you know, and it's like, two different perspectives, you know. It was like one saw it as poverty, the other one saw it as wealth. Like, you know, I didn't have to go to the store. I just climbed a tree and I got mangoes and guanabanas. And it's like, wow. So it kind of reminds me, you know, looking at these stories, listening to you or watching these videos, it's like, man, they have that wealth, you know.
Right.
They have that wealth.
Right.
Jeez.
But,
it's like,
yeah, I mean, it's...
Tell me.
Your perspective, I guess, like, yeah, you're here, us here in the Western world, most people anyway, wouldn't view that as wealth, right? I mean, they would say, yeah, they would say, oh, you can't go to the store and buy stuff, like, what, you got to forage for your own food? What is that? You know, you're living like this more primitive, they would call it, I think, existence.
Mm-hmm.
So, but yeah, you're right. I see the wealth in it, certainly.
Mm-hmm. You know, I work here in East Harlem, and recently I found out there was a Mexican woman who has it's not even a nonprofit. She put it together, and she gets food from the major, like, what do you call it? I guess from the city of New York, they get the food donations, and she used to set up right in the street with the donations. And then long lines of people will come to get the food, you know. And then and now because she doesn't have a space, she had to stop, you know. So it's like the demand is there. People just can't afford to even buy food, you know. So it's crazy how, you know, these indigenous ways, right? It can save a whole lot of families. You know,
yeah.
I have a quick clip here.
Traditional ecological knowledge, we call it.
Aha. Say that again?
That's the term. Sorry, this is an anthropology term. It's called traditional ecological knowledge, or TEK. It's when someone, usually indigenous people, who have been in a particular landscape environment for a long time, obviously they know that environment and that landscape better than anyone, right? So they can make the most of it. They can use it. Use it as a very valuable resource to get what they need and even more so out of it. And it's something that has only kind of recently come to light in the anthropology world, that this traditional knowledge is actually very valuable to modern day farmers and communities who are suffering from poverty and hunger, because they will know how to make the best use of the land and the environment to produce the most food, right?
Mm-hmm. I don't know if this happened in Philly when you grew up and stuff, but I know here in New York City, like in East New York where I was raised, there's a famous bay. It's called Jamaica Bay. And there's actually a reserve in Jamaica Bay. And then there's Rockaway Beach, which is ocean. And and it was other famous, and then some rivers. It was well known, you know, Boricuas or whatever, you know, the island, Caribbean folks would fish in those areas. They'll fish for crabs, they'll fish, you know, and they'll do whatever they could, you know. And I remember as a kid, a lot of people used to come with the fish, the crabs, And this is from the Jamaica Bay or...
Yeah,
or,
I'm wondering how,
Far Rockaway.
I don't know, were any of those fish have like five eyes or anything?
Well, I remember there was a technique they used though to clean them. I remember my great-grandmother used to buy them, and there was a technique they used to clean them and take all the, I guess the toxins out, whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I remember I went
once.
Yeah, I
feel like you'd have to, right?
Yeah, but they had techniques for it. I don't know. See, they may do, you know? They may do.
Yeah,
and
I
remember a man used to sell the crabs, and he used to go to Jamaica Bay, and I was able to go one day to see where they do it. And it's like, wow, these all Caribbean men trying to, like, doing that hustle, right? You know, they learn, right? Hey, where's the river? Where's the bay? You know? Let's see what we can do. What we used to do back in the islands, right? Damn.
Right.
Man, it's crazy.
Exactly.
That's what you just reminded me.
Yeah.
Hey,
survival is.
Survival, right? It's those survival skills as indigenous people. Hey, you know, I got a clip of Panchito from this video, and I love what he said, because this happens all the time. Ready for this? Hold on a second. I'm going to play right now. Wait, hold on. I got a problem with my sound. Hold on a second. Let me see if I... I love that. I love when he said that.
I love that too. Yes, my grandfather was Indian. My great grandfather was an Indian. Nobody can tell me I'm not. And he's so passionate about it when he says it too. You can hear it in his voice.
Yep, and it's so practical, man. I don't know how many people have come to my table with the library. First thing that comes from there, you know, my great grandmother was Indian, or my great uncle was Indian, blah, blah, blah. They'll see me. It says, but what are you? If they're Indian, what are you? And they were like, well, I'm not Indian, you know, like, oh, man, it's like, you know. So his
Panchito
is straight up. He's saying it straight up, man. This is who I am
because. Because of who I came from.
Wow, that's just amazing. Oh, you know, I want to remind the callers, if anyone wants to call in, our number is 515-602-9792. That's 515-602-9792. Also, let me see if I can do this correctly. Some people are really shy. They don't want to call in. So I'm going to open up maybe a chat.
Okay.
Hold on a second. If anybody wants.
That's high tech.
Yeah, there it is. If anyone wants to chat. The chat room is open.
Awesome.
If anyone wants. If they don't want to. Hold on a second. Let me just write something really fast. Okay, if anyone wants to write.
Like I'm...
Tell me. Uh-huh.
Oh, I was just to say, I'm always excited to, because when I talk to like other Cubanos and everything, they either don't know about their indigenous heritage, or they say it was just not really talked about among them, and they're always not sure. They're like, are we Taíno? Are we not? Because we don't hear about it as much as like Boricuas or anything.
Uh-huh.
And so, and again, that whole myth that I was talking about before was that, oh yeah, no. Cuba, they all disappeared. And I'm like, that makes no sense. Cuba was the biggest island of them all. Like, let's stop and think about this for a sec. People are always, when I talk to other Cubanos, they're always like, oh, you know, I always wondered about that, but I always just figured, because that was kind of the general narrative, that I didn't have any Taíno heritage, because that's what I've been taught. And I'm like, I bet you, you're wrong. I mean, it could be. I'm just saying, like, don't assume nothing until you like really look into it, because that may have been what you've been told. But even if, like, this one girl was talking to me, she's like, I think I only had I took a test and it said I only have like 3%, and I said, that's something. I said, you know, I mean, I like going back. I said that means your great great grandparent was close to full blood, and a culture that was considered extinct, you know, since what, the 1500s or something. That's pretty impressive. So
that
don't
is
credit
survival.
That small amount. I mean, yeah, it seems small compared to other things, but when you put it in the perspective of it, it really is more of a, I think it's a more of an impressive statement of resilience, if anything.
Yeah. And you know, there's a, let me see if I find it. There's a BBC article that I found, some travel magazine. It talks about Cuba's Taino people, a flourishing culture.
Yeah, I've seen that. Yep. I've seen that article.
And there's a quote here that's very similar.
They quote Jose in that too, I think.
Yeah. But there's something here. They talk about DNA. Let me see. Let's see if I can find it. I just lost it because I was trying to read the title. But okay, here it is. It says, Native American ancestry 8% nationwide, and it climbs to 15% in eastern provinces.
Right.
But
or
that's,
more sometimes.
Yeah, but that's just as close. That's just the same statistics as Puerto Rico. You know,
more
Puerto
or less,
Rico,
yeah.
It goes up to 15% because you know when you mix, when you add the European, it kind of dilutes the DNA. But it's 15% is huge. You know,
yeah,
and
absolutely.
So a lot of these companies only go what, like four generations, you know? So
right. So and what you got to remember with indigenous, with the idea of indigenous heritage too, is blood quantum isn't really a thing for a lot of tribal identity. You know, it's a colonial construct. The idea for a lot of them was, can you trace a relative from either, and the majority from at least what I've seen, and I think Taino included, are matrilineal. So it's like, as long as you have a female relative who you can trace and who you know was of this nation or that nation, then that makes you of that nation as well. And of course, you got to consider things like adoptions as well. People who were adopted were considered just as much a part of an indigenous nation as those who were born into it. So
exactly.
When that comes into play, then you really, it expands the idea of what makes someone native, because blood alone does not do it. It has, you know, it's family ties, it's clan identities, and a lot of the same thing, or in a lot of particular nations, it's how they trace their heritage, through whether it's patrilineal, matrilineal, and it can, as long as you know a relative or can point out that relative, then again, it goes through you. Even myself, you know, my father was white American, Scottish and German mainly, but I have my Taino through my mother's side, so being a matrilineal society, I'm pretty much on the same level as her. And if I have my own children, even if with somebody who's not Taino at all, they technically still have it through me, right?
Exactly. Wow. Well, listen, there's a quote here I want to ask you about. It's from Balacoa historian. Alejandro Balacoa. He's a historian from there. His name is Alejandro
Another
Hartman.
Another beautiful part of the Eastern Island.
Ah, there you go. Alejandro Hartman Matos. I don't know if you read any of his works, but he says he spent a decade dedicated to rewriting the tale of the Taino demise. And now this is his quote from his article. He says, "There are no more pure bloods, but I know many extended families of Indian heritage that still live in their Aboriginal areas." What do you think about that quote?
Yes, I have. I, as soon as you said that quote, I was like, "Yep, I know who this is. I know this." So again, yeah, I mean, that brings us back to like blood quantum and its importance,
yeah.
Right? Like why even mention that there are no more pure blood? I mean, what makes a pure, what is a pure blood even?
Right.
I know people who live on reservations in North America who who call themselves pure blood, and then they'll do a DNA test and find out they're like 15% Irish or something. So I don't think the idea, I don't think anyone really, and this isn't just indigenous people, I don't think anyone really nowadays especially is pure blood anything. I mean, it's just, it's not a viable concept. I mean, we as humanity, we are constantly moving around. We are constantly admixing. We are constantly either invading or being invaded by other people, immigrating and emigrating. So I think the whole notion of pure-bloodedness of any ethno-linguistic group or racial group is really an outdated and at this point, in my opinion, impossible concept. I don't think you could find an individual nowadays who is pure blood of any one particular ethnicity. I think it's just, and I think it's been that way for several hundreds of years at this point. It's just, it's like I said, it's not viable. Unless you, maybe if you go into a very, very small isolated community. But even then, I mean, there cultures change and people change over time. No culture stays exactly as it was at its beginning. People from different parts come in and out, and it's their admixing takes place. It's whether they realize it or not, it happens. So
now he made a bold statement here. Ready for this one? He estimates there are at least 4,000 Indo-Cubans who are biologically more Taino than not. What do you think about that one?
Yeah, that I that sounds right, and I would estimate that there might even be more, quite honestly, because what you have to rely on when with studies like that, first of all, a lot of them were hoarding. So, you know, when you ask someone what do they identify themselves as, they're going to say whatever they think or whatever they prefer to say. And sometimes that's wrong. Sometimes they don't know, or sometimes, and I know this was especially true in Cuba, a lot of people who weren't fully, you know, white or Spanish Cuban would say they were because it fares better for them, you know? I mean, to say to self-identify as being fully white was basically said made you look like you were of the higher socioeconomic class, right? It saved you from a lot of discrimination. So when you get that kind of, when you do those kind of reports and have people self-identify, a lot of people are going to go with either what is most beneficial or what they think. And like I said before, a lot of Cubans have thought before that they are just purely Spanish with nothing else in there, but it turns out they're wrong. So then if they report, they're going to say, well, you know, I'm more Spanish or more white than anything, but they don't know for sure, do they? So unless you really go and DNA test every single person, that kind of data is sort of notoriously unreliable. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I don't know. It's crazy.
So his estimate, I would say, is a conservative one. I would say it's at least that, if not more.
Yeah. I mean, it's almost like in contradictions. There's no more pure bloods, but he's saying there's 4,000 Indo-Cubans, right?
Right.
Or biologically more Taino.
Right, right. So that's like saying, okay, so again, so nobody who's 100%, like, okay, big whoop. I mean, if there's someone who's more Indio than anything else, I would say that that's just as good, right?
Yeah, man. Now, here's another quote from somebody. I'm going to give her name. Her name is Isolino Cobas Romero. She's described as, in this article, described as a Guajiro. And she is a leader of the El Guarito dance troupe.
Yep.
And this is the quote: "Many people in our communities have Taino blood, but won't admit it. We don't live we don't live exactly like our ancestors, but we're proud of our heritage." Isolinos,
right.
What do you think about that?
I think that pretty much kind of just hits on the head exactly what I said. There's people, right? Like you know, you're not going to admit if something is viewed in your society as unfortunately is the case with any race that's not white, right? It's like the whole idea of even in the Americas of kind of denying any indigenous heritage in North America because it was looked down upon, any African heritage. So people don't want to admit it, right? Because it could result in them being treated lesser or making them feel lesser to some degree. And as she says, we don't live exactly the same way as we did before. And as I pointed out before, that's nobody does. Culture is not static. It changes, it adapts. And that's just the nature of culture. That doesn't make it any less pure. I get people like to put this idea of, oh, well, it's not true, pure Taino culture if it's not exactly the same as it was, you know, pre-Columbus. That's just, you know, no culture is. Cultures will always adapt, will always change, and there is no such thing as a pure culture, in my opinion.
Wow. Well, listen, I got a chat person here, Raul Mato, and he's
awesome.
Reading the article. He's reading the article, and he wants to ask this question. I don't know if it's too political, but let me read where he's highlighting. Okay, the government's acknowledgement of living Taino culture owes much to the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991. Cuba was suddenly critically short on food and medicine. In desperation, it turned to indigenous knowledge of traditional farming and natural medicines, shining a spotlight on a culture it had long denied. So I guess the ultimate question is the government's acknowledgement of Taino culture due to the Soviet Union collapse. What do you think about that one?
Right. I mean, I had heard some things about that. The funny thing about Cuba as it is that it has, as a communist regime, outlasted all of these other Eastern European communist regimes, which is pretty incredible. You know, I mean, the Soviet Union, the USSR was the biggest, right? It was enormous.
That's right.
And Cuba's just one little island. Like, it's, to me, that's mind-boggling, you know, that it's...
Historically,
This regime is... Yeah, and this regime is what, like, close to... It's 60-plus years old at this point, right? It's got to be close to 70 years old, if I'm getting my math right. So, so even... The government who at first, Raul, as you pointed out in that article, it says they kind of denied the existence of indigenous heritage or any remaining indigenous heritage, or kind of swept it under the rug again in favor of a more singular, united state-based identity for Cuban people, really suddenly was not only acknowledging it but dependent on it. And the fact that they are willing, I think, to admit that now, and a lot of progress has been made in terms of the government becoming less strict, at least, than it was, or really kind of expanding itself to include a lot of things it had previously ignored or previously suppressed, if you will. That has definitely happened, I feel like, particularly when it comes to academics, like I said, all these studies that have been done in Cuba, and even like Panchito's family, his nephew was just telling me the Cuban government wants to make a whole documentary about that, like a long feature-length one, and they're funding that completely. So
this is the government? Wow, is that major, or...?
Yeah, that he was telling me they've just recently been contacted, saying that the Cuban government wants to make like a full length feature film about them, their family in particular, and that is pretty major to devote money towards something like that on such a big scale. And it's the other thing about it is though, what I believe anyway, is again, there's a lot of patriotism involved with the current state of Cuba and the Cuban regime and everything, and a lot of pride in history and heritage and who you are as a Cuban. And I think what the regime is starting to realize now is that this is part of that, right? You know, they were all about being Cuban before, but Taíno culture and heritage is part of being Cuban, and Taíno history is part of their history. And I think so now they're glad to kind of, or they're at least starting to be glad to sort of talk about it and broadcast it on a wider scale.
Is that historical in that sense in Cuba for a government to do that, for that communist government to do it?
Or? I can only, I mean, again, I've only been alive 29 years, so I only can speak for what I've seen within my lifetime, but from what I've read and from what I've heard, to put money into something like that is not how it was anyway. You know, back in the regime's early days and up through probably even when I was a younger child, state money would probably not be devoted to a project like that. You know, it would be considered maybe a little excessive and not necessary, mm-hmm. You know what I mean? But so the fact that they are doing that, you know, devoting something to something more artistic, I guess, if you will, if you want to put it into a broad category, artistic in that it's a film, but also historical, I think is pretty impressive.
Oh, man, that's deep. Yeah, very historical. This is, once again, like 1991. Now we got this coming out. Thank God for Panchito and his people that they're resilient. That's some resilience right there. Wow,
and they're
talk
vocal
about...
too, which is what's even more impressive. You know, they're remote. They live in this kind of closed off area, and they're not in a lot of contact with a lot of people, but they've been able to make their presence known in a very big way, to the point where I feel like now every Taíno scholar in person knows who they are, right?
Yeah. I'm reading the article. It says that it looks like they were their descendants, Don Quixote's community, their descendants of, hold on a second, I guess there were villages in the lower region of the mountain, and then they were pushed out, and eventually, here it is. I guess where they live, right? Like Caridad de los Indios, right?
Yeah, Caridad de los Indios. Mm-hmm. Guantánamo, mm-hmm. Baracoa, Juanma, Santiago de Cuba, all those provinces. Both the high, and there were what people forget, and what I think I mentioned when we had the first part of the show, was there were designated villages at one point for, you know, where the conquerors were pushing the Taíno people to. So it's like, so there were basically more or less reservations or you know, early forms of reservations at one point. And while they may not be formally there anymore, the descendants are still there. So,
yeah, I'm looking here. It's a great article. Yeah, it's kind of a good. Let me see. It's kind of a good insight. Let me see if I. It seems like they were in the lowlands. They were living in the lowlands in the region of Guantánamo, and then they said they were Indian families settled after being ousted from their last lowland territory in 1850. So I guess what Panchito is now is they're descendants of those people, those Indian families that were ousted.
Right, that kept getting pushed, you know, further and further away.
Yeah, so it's some historical evidence. Yeah.
Right. And when you think about that, that's not that. I mean, so to say, Taíno went extinct long ago. I mean, 1850, like, it seems like a long time now, but if you're thinking of, you know, history of the Taino people in general, it wasn't that long ago. It was, you know, a little over a century ago or so. A century and a half or so, which is on the grand scale of things, that's recent history, you know? That's not ancient history.
Now they use the word here in an article called Balingue. Balingue, it was families. Hold on a second. I keep losing the place. hold on a second. It was a remote Balingue, where Indian families settled after their outset. And Balingue is, in Spanish, it's a fortified place. And you break it down, it's where slaves lived. This is a community of runaway slaves. You break it down.
Right.
A community of slaves. Yeah. These are runaway slaves, no? They were pushed out. They went to the mountains.
Yep. And that's why I said it's and I compare it to, you know, to reservations too, which were basically, these people who were enslaved or prisoners just kind of being pushed into these designated areas, right?
Right. To die, right?
Pretty much, yeah. I mean,
but they knew the land.
Cuba, yeah, exactly. That's the thing. The good thing about Cuba is it's small enough, and they weren't pushed too far where they were in, like, somewhere that was completely inhospitable.
Right.
They were, and they knew the land, like you said. And Cuba doesn't have as much vast difference across its climate across the country, because it's not as big, obviously, as places like the U.S. where they took Native people from the east and pushed them all the way out into Oklahoma or, you know, other kind of middle of nowhere places where they had never been, had no idea what they were. You know, they were eastern woodland tribes. And basically said, here. The goal was so they would die, basically. Fortunately, they didn't. They learned to, it was hard and miserable, but they learned to adapt. And for our people, I would say it was easier because they were closer. It wasn't as far to go, and they knew the land enough. It was a smaller, more concentrated area. And there's no, I wouldn't say there's any parts of Cuba that are just a wasteland, really. It's a pretty lush, very fruitful climate and environment.
Yo, I can live in those mountains. That'd be cool, man, with the rivers.
Right, so Panchito's nephew, he sent me this photo the other day. I guess they take all these trips to the mountains all the time, which I think is awesome, especially even Panchito himself, who's what, in his 90s, and he's like trekking up mountains all the time still. I mean,
dang,
that's impressive.
I believe it.
I hope I'm not at that level. I hope I am at that level when I'm that old. He took this picture of this area in the mountains, like the really dense, almost like jungle kind of mountains, of his family. They were bathing or playing in it's called the Toa River. Toa River. And he said this is the river that's mentioned in a lot of the legends of the origin of the people, particularly in Cuba. In a lot of Taino folklore as well, the Toa River. So they still go there, and they're still bathing in it and making regular journeys and harvesting a lot of the fruit and everything around it. So
that's
these
amazing
pictures, like it's a great photo. It's these girls, you know, in their like bikinis or whatever, and they're taking selfies in the river. It's great, yeah.
Oh, that's some cool stuff, man. Well, you know, I'm looking at my DNA and 23andMe. I got ancestry in Santiago de Cuba.
That's right. That's where mine is, too, actually.
Well, we're relatives. Hey, what about
that?
But my most concentrated DNA is found in Jorquín.
Yeah.
H-O-L.
Yeah, H-O-L. Yeah, that's not too far, I don't think, is it? From Santiago?
It's right above Santiago de Cuba.
That's right, yeah. I was like, I think that's also an eastern province.
So I'm right above Guantanamo. Yeah, I'm right above it, so wow. So there's like a lot of Tainos out there, right? So my migration story probably began in Cuba. You know, at least migration in the Caribbean. In Cuba.
Yeah,
so
it's again the lore of us coming from the Toa River. I'm looking at this other photo that he sent me. They're in a place of them in a place called Bernardo de Yatera, which is also in that region, kind of.
Mm-hmm.
Beautiful,
wow.
Beautiful country out there.
Oh,
and
man, can you send me that photo privately? I'd just like to check out.
Yeah, of course.
I got to visit those places one day. Go ahead, tell me. Yeah, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, of course. No, you're fine. It's funny that I always think it's cool that Guantanamo and everything is right there, smack dab in the middle of all that where the Taino culture is really centered, right? And the national song of Cuba is Guantanamera, which basically means like someone from Guantanamo, you know? And that has become like pretty much like the national anthem of Cuba, and it's celebrating people from that region specifically. And you mentioned before the article of a woman who mentioned she's Wahira, and they're mentioned in that song too, because it's Guantanamera, Wahira, Guantanamera. And Wahira and Wahiro culture also comes from that same region and is sort of born out of Taino and Spanish blending of cultures as well, similar to the way that Jibaro culture in Puriquen is. So I always find that really awesome that, like, you know, the main song of Cuba is celebrating, you know, it's not about Havana or anywhere like that. It's out here in this the original part of Cuba, you know, where the first people came from.
Oh man, I think that's the key, man. That's the key. Wow, that's the key. That's some cultural continuity, no?
Yeah, absolutely.
Indigenous
cultural
continuity.
Right, yeah, and it's just so, like, a lot of people don't even think, like, people are like, well, what does Guantanamera even mean? I'm like, well, technically it means somebody from Guantanamo. and they say, Wahira, like, Guantanamera. So, like, that's the culture they're singing about. And that's so associated with, like, Cuban patriotism. So I always think that's really awesome.
Yeah, that is some cool stuff, man. You know, it's very similar to Guajiro with the Guajiro, Jibaro, you know, it's all really...
Yeah, Jibaro, Guajiro, we're very, very close, pretty much, you know. It's the idea of really, like, on its face, it's like somebody who lives in the country, really, you know, like a rural person. But if
right.
you deconstruct what it really means a little more, it's like, well, it's people who... I think mix a lot of traditional ecological knowledge, what I was talking about, with, because they live in the environment, closer to the environment and are more dependent on it. So I've always considered them to be more in touch with Taino heritage than other parts of the country, you know?
Oh, yeah. No, man, that's, I'm telling you. Well, listen, we totally ran out of time. Got someone that just wrote me off Messenger and say we got cut off because after the hour, we get cut off. It doesn't go live anymore.
Yeah,
but,
that's right.
Yeah, but everyone can download this show. It's always, all shows are archived. And this is great, man. We had a good time talking Cuba, Cubao, right?
Yes. Cubao. Cubao, yes, exactly. Land, fertile land of plenty.
Oh, that's wonderful. So, hey, let's keep it going. You know, I have an idea for next week's show. If you're interested, I'm going to invite people going to hand select some people to ask some, get some questions. Do you want to focus on a given area or a given history part or what? It's up to you. So I give people some homework.
Any area,
anything you want to talk about that you want people to ask questions and stuff, you know, like a study hour.
Let me think on that.
Yeah, because I have some people that I've been teaching privately and stuff, and so I'm going to get them to write some questions, okay? It'll go on live next week. It'll be the Taino Indigenous Caribbean Studies. But this is great, man. We got to – and one day, you got to take me to Guantanamo. Go back to my ancestors. They're my ancestors, the eastern part of Cuba. You know, I have to go. That's my people's.
Yeah, you know? I got to go back too. It's been years for me.
Yeah. No, I need a passport, right? I mean, a passport has to – can. Oh, wait, Americans aren't allowed, right? Or they are?
Right, yeah. Well, they're not really. You got to get a special visa.
So it has to come – oh, wow. And that takes time, right?
A little bit, yeah. Or if you go from another – like Canada or something, you might be able
Okay, so you fly into Canada first. Then, wow, that's a long trip. Go to Canada, then you got to go down to Cuba.
And then go down south.
Wow.
It's funny. It's so close, yet so far. It's the closest of all the Caribbean islands to America, right? Because, like, it's right off the tip of Florida. But it's so hard to get to.
Oh, man. Then you got to get – and then when we get there, we got to get those horses, right? We go up to Guantanamo and shit, man. Los Taínos están aquí, Nueva York.
Oh, God. I got a picture of me on one of those horses.
Oh, where? Oh, man.
Yeah, I'll find that and send it to you.
Well, you know, my car broke down in Puerto Rico and Corozal. I was so tempted to buy a horse for $150 because there's a lot of people using horses for transportation.
Sounds about right. Yeah. Same thing.
So I'm late.
Hard to find working cars in Cuba, so a lot of people use horse and carts and stuff.
Look at that, man. You know, horse was indigenous to Turtle Island, so there we go. So,
yeah.
At one point, right? So,
they were brought over a bunch of them escaped and from Spaniards that came like long, long ago.
Oh, yeah.
And then went wild and then they became kind of indigenous.
Yeah. No, but I was reading that in prehistoric times we had the horse.
Oh, you're going that far back.
Yeah, I'm going way back. Yeah, it was the ancestor of the horse, you know. During the Ice Age that they got stuck in the icebergs or whatever, or the icebergs, and they ended up in Europe. I don't know. Asia and Europe.
Yeah.
And then they were brought back.
They found their way back.
And the horses are beautiful, man. So, well, listen, we ran out of time, man. We got this. Indigenous Caribbean study hour. We're a little over time, but you got any little final comments to make before we leave?
No, I mean, I feel bad if anybody else, I don't know if you still got that chat or anything, but people can always comment on the from the website, right? If they want to download the episode, I encourage, you know, any and all questions. I'm always happy to answer or any comments or anything. Keep it coming.
Oh, man, that's beautiful, man. So we'll wrap it up, and here we are. So listen, you take care. I'll see you next week on Tuesdays, right? We're going to be at Tuesdays.
Yeah.
Right after the paranormal show on Mondays, we got Tuesday Taino Studies. Indigenous Caribbean Taino Studies. And we got this coming. All right, man. So you take care. Bo Matum, thank you for your time.
Yeah. All right. Thank you.
Awesome.
Have a good one.
Okay. Calibre. <There you
go. laughs> Sí, viva Cuba. Cuba libre.
chévere. Bye-bye.
Yeah. Bye.
All right. Chévere. Bye-bye.